So let me introduce Hans Meyer. I don't think it's really new, but let me tell you about the first time I met Hans, and I don't think you remember.
No.
This was that's kind of an impression I have. This was when Casper van der Wal was your student, and we somehow met Casper and I. About quantum computing, and he's now a professor at the University of Groningen, as I understand it. And so, why do I tell this? This was in 97, 98. So already then, Hans was thinking about quantum computing, and I guess we'll come to hear about his latest endeavors.
Actually, the time we started thinking about quantum computing with these kinds of objects was right here. I went to a workshop in 96 here on quantum information and tried to find out whether we could do anything. Now, we've been doing something, but today you will see again how little we are doing. Lucky, not don't expect too much. 1 qubit, 2 qubits. And some ideas. That's, and the title started as the introduction to superconducting qubits and possible quantum simulation. But that was too long, so I ended up with this title. But it's a bit promising to me, I'm afraid. Anyway, I'll tell all I have to tell. So I will still give a short introduction on superconducting qubits in general. Give you some idea. I will then talk a bit more about our particular type, the type that we study in Delft, the flux qubits, that is one of the different types, and then some ideas and some pictures about quantum simulation, possible quantum simulation with the flux qubits, and but also with quantum phases. Now, superconducting qubits. First, in general, about superconductors, we all describe it as the order parity, the phase is dominating here in these stories. Voltage is the change of the phase. If I close loop and I go around, the phase has to bite its own tail, but the flux returns, gives this boundary condition. We use Johnson junctions. Think of these as very small, 100 nanometers or smaller sandwiches. It's typically aluminum. It's almost always aluminum. And then there's a bit of aluminum oxide in between, made in situ. It has capacitance because it has this sandwich structure. We indicate Johnson junctions with this cross, and a regular Johnson junction has energy, binding energy that's proportional to its critical current. The capacitance, we put in the capacitive energy, and then the energy, which we call the classical energy of this superconducting object, is the charging energy, connected with dynamics. Q is, of course, the voltage on the capacitor, and the voltage is associated with changes in time. So this is a dynamic term, and this is a static term. So think of the Johnson potential as a static background, and if we move in that static potential, then the mass is the capacitance. The capacitance provides the inertia, and the total current is, of course, a change of time. So that is said again, if you have a circuit with multiple junctions, and each junction introduces a quantum degree of freedom, we have the phase. And the charge, phase and charge in these superconducting systems are conjugate variables. If you have multiple circuits, you have to find what the proper quantization is by finding the Lagrangian or Hamiltonian, but we all know that. So we think of the Johnson energy's potential, charging energy, kinetic energy, and you have a choice. One can do the quantization starting from the phases, or start with discrete Cooper pair numbers. It depends a bit on the numbers what is most objective. Now, at this time, there are 3 qubits that you hear of, but these are the originals. Now, let me if you think of making a two-level system with superconductors, this is the obvious choice. You take a junction, you put a gate voltage here, and then look at how much extra charge there is on that island between the capacitor and the junction and another capacitor. That is part of the junction, actually. You know, you change the gate voltage and you see the energy go, and here there is a superposition of charge states on this island, for instance, between zero Cooper pairs and one extra Cooper pair on the island. So this, and the strength of that avoided crossing depends on the strength of this Joule-Joule coupling. So this is the easiest one. That's the one I worked on when I was here 30 years ago. But in practice, it's a bad one, and I'll come to that. This is the flux qubit. So what you have here is a closed loop with a weak spot, at least one weak spot. And now we study, let's say, closed loop can continue. If you take the phase around, you can come back to zero, or this combine or something like that, you can come flux sites. It's not really contact flux. And so we get superposition of states. In the strength of this avoided crossing here depends again on the junction, but in more complicated way. And then other qubits, and particularly qubits that are very successful now, I would characterize as oscillation qubits. So what you have is a Josephson potential, for instance, something looking like that, where you sit in one of those potential wells that has been designed to be good on, and now you get quantum oscillations and use two of those levels as the two-level system for the qubit. If you use this, of course, if it's really harmonic oscillator, there, the third level is pretty, the distance between those, see, level one and two is almost the same as between two and three, but it's a disadvantage. If you drive it, you might excite the third level very much. In general, there are always more levels, but it's nice if you have two that are separated from the rest. That is a bit of an issue in this kind of qubit. You really have to make sure that the unharmonicity is large enough, so that, or you have to make sure that you don't drive the qubit too strongly, otherwise you can leak your quantum information to higher levels.
Can those conceivably be used for qubits, or is that completely ridiculous?
No, it's not good. At the end of my talk, I will not talk about prints, but at four, what's that called? Quaternits or something. Yeah, we can make those, absolutely. So this is the quantum Cooper pair box again. This is the classical Hamiltonian. If you quantize it, you get something like that, and you get the same picture. I more or less gave that again. The flux qubit in practice has three junctions, otherwise you have to make it very large. The strengths of what you get are two states with opposite circulating currents. If you put about half a flux on to the loop, it work in this neighborhood, and then the strength of the level separation depends now on the ratio of the Josephson coupling energy and the charging energy. Around in here, this is more or less the oscillation potential, and so what is important is that it depends exponentially on the junction strength. And the junction strength depends exponentially on barrier thickness. So we have an object, a device, where an important parameter is an exponent of an exponent. And that means that we get quite some variation when it's fabricated, even if we control everything very well.
So big delta makes for stable systems that already.
Why? No.
Oh, okay.
No. You want delta to have a minimum value. It depends where you want to work. So you like delta to be something like 5 or 10 gigahertz or so. Yeah. But it's not that if it's bigger, it's more stable.
Okay.
And it's dependent. The phase qubit, and that qubit is studied very, very successfully right here in Santa Barbara, fourth floor of Berlia Hall, by a group of John Martinez. That is, in principle, a single junction, and it's also energy Johnson Avenue of the single junction is the cosine. If you put a current, it's tilted, and that way one can make these wells pretty shallow, and that means that the frequency, the oscillation frequency, that's lower. The frequency here might be 100 gigahertz. That's very impractical, very expensive to work in that frequency range. So you can lower it by putting a current and cutting on like three levels and use some of them. This is the way it's worked out. And it's extremely important that the current line is very stable. The Martinez group has worked out a very intricate scheme with the, basically a charge flux in the superconducting loop that is big, that couples to the qubit. And in the end, they have the system. This is the system with the levels. And then what happens is that you do operations here, you occupy this level, put microwaves to this transition, and then to read out whether the tumor is excited, basically you lower the barrier for a short time, and if the qubit is in a higher level, it can escape to a system that has many levels, it will stay there. But if it's in the ground state, it cannot escape. And that is the way the measurement is done. This is how it looks. These are two qubits. And they're designed. The qubits are really well-designed contained units. If you have multiple qubits, they will be in different places. In this case, the coupling is by capacitor. So the qubits don't feel each other very much. They are separate units. And this group has done extremely beautiful things. One is this year proving that Bell's inequality is violated. Of course, not far enough apart to talk about a real test of quantum mechanics, the aspect type of zooming. I mean, this is sitting in the city chip, but still, and the other aspects. And this is a beautiful measurement where this qubit is coupled to a high Q-harmonic oscillator, and by using the qubit to generate photon states in the oscillator, they managed to make this. These are examples. This is here. This is an experiment. The superposition of having one photon in the oscillator plus zero, and superposition of that, that is here plus two photons, here plus three, so four, they could do all of them. And also in their publication put something, I don't remember, a certain fraction of three photons and seven photons and something. And that's a really arbitrary state. Fox states, and the readout is done with the qubits again. So they're excellent. This is another group that's been very successful. This is a completely different type of qubit. They start from the Cooper pair box. This thing looks a bit different because it has a bit of extra capacity. But it is starting from the Cooper pair box, the charge qubit. And it's been taken, this will be the real charge qubit with EJ of EC, even one, but the real charge qubit EC will be much larger. But now if you increase the Johnson energy relative, what happens is that as a function of the charge, the gate voltage, the induced charge, here there are big wrinkles, here it's completely flat. So if you want a Cooper pair box, this is of course bad because you don't see anything anymore. But what they do now is use this system in combination with the harmonic oscillator. And in the end, it can be described as a kind of oscillator. I will not try to describe it too much detail. But it's again another type of potential that scales with the Johnson energy in their oscillations. And the way this group operates their qubits is always by using the oscillator. They so far never looked at the qubits directly. All they do is show pictures. So they use a harmonic oscillator. A harmonic oscillator in this case is a strip line folded up because it's the length is 4 centimeters. It's short because it resonates, so it's running away in this micro step ladder. This is a high fuel oscillator. A million or so fuel. And the frequency depends on what is it here, 6 gigahertz or so, and 3 or 6. And what they do is really look, you see an example here of this would be the qubit, and the Josephson's change of the Cooper box is changed. This is the oscillator here, and if you know of this, this is the avoided crossing line. And also across it. All the measurements they do are on the oscillator. And the oscillator is influenced by the qubit. The oscillator, there's dispersion, the oscillator, if you measure transmission or the phase of the reflected wave from the oscillator, from that you can determine what the qubit state is. Not only the oscillator state, but also the qubit state. Strong advantage of this method is that there are no lines leading to the qubit, and everything that you connect to the qubit is bad, gives decoherence. This oscillator is in itself a filter, it's a high Q oscillator, so all the other frequencies except the oscillating frequencies are filtered out. So it's, in that sense, it makes life very easy. The disadvantage of relying on this thing is that you can do 1 qubit, you can do 2 qubits, you can still distinguish them. I think they can do 3, but I'm sure they cannot do 8 with one oscillator because they all wipe out, and it's very difficult to keep them separate. If you have only one line to address all of them. But so far it's fantastic. And they this year published a paper where they did algorithms. Now people that do, let's say, have been doing quantum information on paper for a long time will not be impressed with the kind of algorithms that were it was search, and it was the other one. Very simple algorithms that you could do in your sleep. This thing, it worked, and that was the first time you if only 2 qubits. And this is state-of-the-art for supercomputing qubits, or for that matter, for also the safe qubits. Nobody has any more than that. So, what is the problem with these superconducting qubits? Typical frequencies, level separations are in this range. You could go higher, but your electronics become more expensive. You don't want to go much lower because you like to start what you do by letting the thing stabilize, just wait so that the qubit is in the ground state. If you go too low, you have to start with already occupation inside the state. All these measurements, by the way, are done in the Lucier refrigerators, you know, just to really Kelvin. But you can, if you work on them, they can be done. Operation times are this order depending on the type of qubit. Some are advanced than others. And of course, what you want is the coherence time that is many times the operation time. And the coherence times for well-designed qubits are, let's say, of order microseconds. But if you put more of them together, it's quite likely that your coherence time will go down until you found out which bit wrong. And why is that? There are two main sources of decoherence in these systems. One is in the circuit. For instance, our flux qubit, if I take a separate flux qubit and put it in the universe somewhere, or let's say on the chip, but don't connect it, then the coherence time will be very large. It will in the end be limited by this, but it will by itself be large. But if I put a line to put changing flux, for instance, to drive it, then that will introduce decoherence. So in the end, you need a lot of electronic checks to get it right. And that is where one group is better than the other group, to understand how to do it. And if you go to multiple qubits, this gets progressively more difficult. And this is what really limits us in here, is microscopic defects. One is flux noise, for instance, or monograph. So as you start by saying, why don't we use compact boxes to charge qubits? That is because charge noise, holograph noise of charge, is extremely strong in everything we make. If we knew a good trick to get rid of that, that would be fantastic. But if you make a circuit, you find that already to start with, there's a static offset of order either 2E or so. So you never know where you begin. And there's a lot of noise. So that means that charge qubits don't work in that region. But there are others. I mean, there's flux noise, and the source of that is a strong dispute. It could be electrons being trapped and deep trapped. It could be other objects. Another thing that clearly is important is that sometimes you have parasitic two-level systems that have, this, for instance, the same frequency as your qubits or limits at T1. And for that, the group here at Zulzberger, they had a lot of problems because they used big junctions and now they use smaller junctions, as you say, with fewer defects and introduce some extra capacitance to come in the right range. But something, I mean, for all three qubits, not for the charge qubits, for the others, coherence time T2, T1, and of order a microsecond can be used. But you don't always have it if you need it. So that's in general. Let me talk a bit more about the flux qubit. This is an old example. This is the loop with three junctions. This thing we put around to measure. So we measure the two basic states are circulating currents in the ring. We use the squid here with two junctions. The critical current of that squid depends on the across flux. So in that way, we can determine the state of the qubit. And here, as I said, we have the ground state. Here at the symmetry point, the symmetric superposition, the anti-symmetric superposition of the circulating state. But here the energy does not depend on the flux, and that means that there's no dephasing due to flux. So if you can run the system here, that helps for coherence. But if you run it there, you cannot measure anything because the current here and the current there are both zero. So there's nothing in there. So what we do in those cases is start here, flip the qubit, take it here, let the system sit here, then to read out, move it out very fast in milliseconds, and then measure it there, and hope that it doesn't jump to the state. Okay, these are the currents that you measure. Okay, let me skip this. Because, as I said, the delta in this equation that we are sitting, this is induced by the bias flux, but this is the avoided crossing here, and that is an exponent of an exponent, and that's why we need some extra control. So now we make flux qubits where we replace one junction by a double junction, we change the flux in that loop. And that way we can tune now this distance. So this is the same device, tune the delta here. The danger, of course, is you have an extra line and it introduces the current. So the first sample of this kind was not too good, but now it's actually this one, but the other one, the new one, is bringing in very nice results. Now what did we do with the flux qubits? This is an example of a CNOT gate. Two qubits are coupled inductively. So basically what you have is, this is a four-level system, but you have two qubits. The control qubit can be up or down. The other qubit feels the control qubit and the influence is of the order of 200 megahertz, so it goes 200 megahertz. The level of the target qubit goes up 200 megahertz, so it goes down. Now we get the pipe on the target qubit, and that is only resonant for one state of the control qubit, and it won't do anything for the other state of the control qubit. And that's a very simple signal. And the funny thing is we get four, so you see that this is the transition that we use. But you could also have used this one or another one. So basically the same devices for signal operations on different corresponding to four different bell sets. You can control the check that the phase is correct also. So that works. This I like to tell also, this is a measurement where we in the end do quantum non-denoration. The measurement is with the script, but we don't measure the critical current. We measure the inductance of the script, which is inversion proportional to the critical current. We make it this is a system that was first applied over the script by Stanicki and others at Geode. So we get a hysteretic detector. The detector has two states, the qubit has two states, and of course we work it out in such a way that each detector state corresponds to one of the qubit states. Here you see the readout now. This is the qubit in the ground state, and the detector readout is histogram peaks around a certain value. If we give a bypass to the qubit beforehand, we get another peak here, and only a small peak there. And if we get a pi of a 2 peak before a peak, I think more or less symmetric. So it's really split. It's really, we can distinguish the two states. And what we also can do in this case is we have a measurement, and we do, after the first measurement, we do the second measurement about 60 nanoseconds apart. And the bomb is long enough that it's significant. So if, let's say in this case, the ground state of the qubit corresponds to the high amplitude state of the detector, the H state. So if we measure H first, then the conditional probability to measure H in the second measurement is extremely high. So the qubit goes from the ground state to the exact, this is the Rabi oscillation, this is only the first readout, and you see ground state, excited state, ground state, excited state. So we are in the ground state, so there are very few occasions where this detector has a ground state to work with. But you can see it's completely flat. For the excited state, it's the correlation is lower, and that is because between the two measurements there is some relaxation.
So why doesn't the root curve depend on the time difference of the T1?
Why should
it see the relaxation?
Delta T1 is the length of the first pulse. So delta T1 is the length of this pulse. It does depend on the time in between.
So the time between first and second measurements is fixed.
In this, what I show here, but I have not in my presentation now, but in my computer, I have the plot where I shift that way and I see it fall off exponentially. And that corresponds precisely to the relaxation time that you can be measuring in another experiment. So it's really relaxation. That's why now there's more to say about this. The detector itself also influences the relaxation, whether it's in the high state or low state. So, there's a story. But this is, I think, the only quantum non-liberation, certainly with the supercomputer systems. Now what we're working on, and have results, but not yet definite results, is to combine this on two qubits to have, we still not really sure that we have two qubits, but here we have two couple of qubits. We have now the readout on the two qubits of the same kind, of the QND kind. The sample that we it is running right now, and I get measures every day. Unfortunately, the coherence is not quite good enough for what we want. We want also to test Bell inequality. But the readout is fantastic. It's very independent. The crosstalk, the total crosstalk is lower than 0.1%. Even if we use high frequency pulses and partly use the same cool amplifier, etc. And then these things are very close together. That's great. It's all things running. I like to show this one, but I also got sent over here. This is and your sample is the tunable, alpha tunable delta qubit. What you see here is the qubit, and now it's coupled to an oscillator. In this case, the oscillator is in the circuit. It's not a high Q oscillator, but this is the oscillator frequency, and that is the qubit as a function of a blank flux. So you see nice avoided crossings here, that works. You can see the strength of the coupling. This is a gigahertz scale, so this is of order 100 megahertz. But now, this value can be tuned up, delta can be increased, and you see now this one approaching the frequency, and here the qubit splitting is exactly equal to the oscillator frequency. What you see here is that the oscillator branch is pushed down, the qubit branch is pushed up, but this is where you can really move through this, for instance. And then of course you get, if you have a system like that, you get vacuum around the oscillations. They are measured in this way. It starts here, this frequency is a bit low, it creates some occupations. So what it does is start here, you do it in the ground state, I should do it here. And then go here very fast, let it sit there for a certain time, and then go back. And then very little time you stay here. This scale is, this is the flux. This is the time, the length of the time you spend here. So the longer you spend here, the more oscillations. This is not microwave-induced oscillations, but vacuum band oscillations. Photon swapping between the qubit and the oscillator. So you can do that and control it.
Are there multiple frequencies or just one?
That's one. So
why does it look, in the middle figure, why does it look like there are other lines in between the...
You mean this way?
No, in the middle and the top.
Sorry.
On the top, in the middle.
Here?
No, top of your slide.
The blue here.
I'm talking about the oscillator, the anticrossings between the oscillator and the qubit.
You mean here?
Yeah, or on the left. So the one in the middle is the most... So
yeah.
I don't know what...
Sorry. I don't know.
if I look at this picture.
No, I actually asked Arkady Perov. He sent me this 2 days ago.
Okay.
I like it. And I asked him, what is this? This is the oscillator.
But
partly it's like, two photon processes.
It also looks like there are two frequencies in the plot in the bottom.
Okay, don't ask me to.
Okay.
Basically, it's and there are details that need explanation, but I don't have it here.
Okay.
No, I'm in discussion with them. Okay, let me now also try to say something about simulation, because I promised that in the title. So I hope I showed you that we can do things with these circuits, but that it's not so easy. I mean, the paper is easy, but it's not easy to do it well in practice. Everything is complicated. Now, I have been thinking, and my plan when I came here is really also to work out more what can we do in quantum simulation. But I haven't done so much here yet, but I hope in the later time to. Let me first show you some old measurements that in a way are quantum simulations. And this is not qubits. This is talking about quantum vortices. So we have an array of junctions, and you can see this array is 100 by 100 junctions. It's large. It's a 2D network. And these junctions are small, and it's very homogeneous. If you pay attention, you would say, no, it's not homogeneous. This junction is much larger than that one. It's 3 times larger. But then, if you look, that one is also. That was done on purpose for a particular experiment that I'll describe a bit later. But if you do it like that, the variation in junction parameters is like 5% or so. And the areas are very precise. So you can put a magnetic field, and the flux in each loop will be within the tenths of a percent, be the same two different groups. Okay. We had a number of, I summarized them here. These are six different experiments that we did over a certain period of time. All long ago, more than 13 years ago. This is the first one, just look at the phase transition. That's called the Mithouris type transition. This is another type of, this is called the phase transition, where we change the Johnson energy to Coulomb energy ratio. If the Coulomb energy is high, you go to low temperatures, it becomes an insulator. But if the Johnson energy is higher, it goes down, it becomes superconducting low temperatures. And there are very interesting samples in between, particularly if you also have a magnetic field. This one is interesting. If you look at the resistance at low temperatures and you change the frustration is the flux per unit cell divided by the flux column, then there are these dips, and they occur when the flux lattice is commensurate with the junction lattice. For instance, if you have one flux column per three junction cells, then it fits, and then you get, but this is a fourth, this is one third, this is one half. So then the resistance goes down here. You could, for instance, the vortex lattice is bent, but it's not. These are common things. Now, if you go from zero vortex density and you increase the density, vortices, these vortices are common particles. We know that from many aspects. So if you increase the density of these common particles, which are bosons, then what you get is a boson condensation. The density is high enough. And now you have a fluid of common vortices somewhere it crosses over, and the signature of that is that here at the lowest densities, if you increase the temperature, this is low temperature and the dotted line is higher temperature, then at higher temperature the vortices are more mobile. More mobility of vortices is more resistance. But if you go over to the superfluid, now it's the other way around. Now if you increase it, so now excitations in the superfluid, the temperature dependence reverses there. And interestingly, that also happens around 1/4 and 1/3 and 1/2. You get these points also. So this, we didn't immediately call it like that in publication, but afterwards it's very clear that it will see. There's another one, we take a vortex and split it to paths and then let them interfere. So this is Ahrenbohm, but Ahrenbohm is charged around the flux. This is flux around the charge. So we change the charge on iron and then see interferences. This gets more in the region what iron people call cold insulations also. This is an hot insulator. So what we see here are these extremely sharp lines at 1/3, but we see them also at 2/19, things like that. But this is 1/3. Minus 1/3. Really very sharp lines that are very easy to miss if you sweep the magnetic field, because you just sweep through it. But here, this is in a 1D type array, and here the vortex is really strongly bent in the junction lines.
What's N?
Sorry. N is the density. So this is a quasi one-dimensional array of vortices. So the density, the one-dimensional density of vortices is per cross set. So you need to go three cells and there's another vortex, and again. But these vortices are free to move, to influence each other. In this case, it's very simple. N is the vortex density.
And so how much control do you have over the individual elements of when you have such a big array?
This one is 1,000 long and 7 wide.
Okay.
So it's, the vortices are pinned in this 7 wide thing. They can only go through the middle, but they're called vortices. They can move. They have a certain width by themselves. But you can see how well it works. It's the same in all the cells, otherwise you would never get these flips.
Do you also see features in other rational fractions?
Yes.
So not just 1 over an integer, but 2 over an integer?
Yeah. A whole lot of them.
Yeah.
Actually, also here. But here it's much deeper, much more dramatic. And well, 3rd is the strongest, but typically the strongest. But there are a lot of them. All problems are stronger than even ones. I forgot to start here. Right? This is another one that I like. That is the same long array. Now what we did is put in, I showed you the picture where some of the junctions were stronger than the others. So we make a cross row, 7 junctions cross. We make a row of junctions that are 3 times stronger than the others. That is a real barrier. If we have this potential where the vortices move in, this is the only potential they can move easily. This barrier is twice as high as the regular amplitude. It's really high barrier. Now, if we put these barriers exactly at 10 cells apart from each other, it turns out that the vortex is mobile at your temperatures. As it should, because if you have a periodic lattice, a common particle in the periodic lattice forms a band and it can move in the band. So, now what we did is first take this lattice with high temperature is on, this is low temperature part anyway. So this is the regular lattice. But what we also did is, we had these barriers 10 cells apart, and now with a random generator in fabrication, we put them at 9, 10, or 11. So the average density is the same. We know the shape of these barriers. They are much below, they are only 1 or 2 cells wide, the barriers, so they're independent. So if you put them at 9, 10, 11, it's random. There is no higher barrier, the barriers are the same, but there is randomness. And now we find that the mobility goes to 0 for low temperatures. So this is anisomorphization. Not with qubits, but with holomorphics. So what can we do with qubits? I want to talk about that, obviously. Well, flux qubits are natural objects to couple. Easier than other ones, than the other ones. Charged qubits, pure charged qubits could be coupled easily. But flux qubits, you take a loop, you put a loop next to you, so the 2 qubits already can easily extend. So inductive coupling is easy to realize. This is an old paper that was never published, but I still like. That was the first prediction of what you could do. So if you have flux qubit fabrication, one qubit with all these circuits is complicated, but to make a long chain is as easy. You just repeat the fabrication, doesn't matter if you have 100 or more, as long as you can do it in one run of the lithography. So you can put a lot of them this evening. So these are predictions, these are different Hamiltonians that could realize on paper. Now, the Majorana story didn't really hold experimentally because we could not really reach it as you didn't know how to manage it. This is another paper, prediction theory. This is now a spin chain. This, of course, is an icing chain, Coulomb icing chain, artificially fabricated. So, this is Bruder, and starting to calculate it. If you have this chain, you hit it on one side, what do you measure on the other side? You excite it here, and can you have propagation of quantum information? And this was his prediction. So his conclusion was, yes, you can have, with high fidelity, have transmission. As experimentalists, we're not so happy because that only happened at one specific time that you don't know in advance. So how do you really do that? I still feel this is... But, okay, anyway, there is something.
Why don't you know the time? It seems to be
Because this time is units of the Joseon time, and you don't know that so precisely, and etc. It amounts to having to do the measurement within another, precisely in another second.
Okay.
And you always measure something, but no, not encouraging.
Yeah.
But so we went to work on chains of flux qubits. These are fabricated samples. These are pictures of various designs. But I have to confess, Laura really worked hard on these same systems, and we did measurements. So you can see, for instance, in this case, we have this is a squid again that measures a large number of qubits. The prediction that in the classical ground state for this Eisen chain would be an antiferromagnetic. These qubits are antiferromagnetically coupled, so you expect that classical ground state would be an antiferromagnet. So you would expect that they would alternate up, down, and down statically. It doesn't hold it. So this is what we wanted to measure first. And now we also had in various samples, we had things at the end so that we could kick it to one end and measure it on the other. Now we have no conclusive data here. And in the end, this was a side project for us, just one student, and she at some stage had to give up and do something that would lead to more clear results. But yeah, you can make the samples, but it's not so easy to get the information. You can speculate on paper, though. This is another one that we could do. So regular qubits, as I showed, would have sigma z coupling. Sigma z is the current variable. Sigma x is the strength of the tunneling. Now, as I showed you, if we have this alpha loop, we vary the strength of this loop, we can change the sigma x in the qubit. Now, in this case, in this way, we could couple the circulating current in this qubit, which is the qubit state, couple it to the sigma x of the next qubit. So there are ways of making different kinds of coupling. And I showed you before, you can also do it capacitively. The disadvantage of capacitive coupling is that the offset charge when you begin is so random with one. The coupling will be strong, the other will be weak, there will be much randomness there. But this should in principle work. Now what I want to talk about and what I'm trying to work on here is, as I promised, a four-state system. That's that one. But as an introduction, let me first talk about this one that we never made, but when I worked on it a bit, and so okay. In the beginning, I thought it might be an interesting qubit. So what the idea is here, you take a closed superconducting loop, you put it down in the field, so that one flux arc is trapped there, very strong, it's there, it cannot escape. So it means that there is a circulating current in this loop, and that forces the system, it induces frustration in this whole system. And the result is that in this network there has to be one vortex, or one flux of it. And it has to sit in a specific cell. Now, the edges are unfavorable because the strong loop repels vortices like that. So in the end there are two places that are equivalent where it can sit. So now you have two states which are spatially separated. Not necessarily, I mean, even spatially separated. And if you take the right value of this junction, you can make superpositions of being here and there. And this is the same thing, but now for a square, and you have four equivalent states. For the four-state object, let's say the qubit, I don't think is better. That was at a time when I thought that the flux noise came from the outside, but if it's intrinsic, it doesn't help anything. So, but still, I think it's interesting to think about objects like that. If we put a current line on top, I mean, separated by an insulator, of course, then it means that we have a negative flux here, positive there, or the other way around. So now we tilt we dealt the levels, so spatially separated. First degenerate, one goes up, the other goes down. And here we can put two lines and tilt it in two different directions. Now, if you want to know how a system like that behaves as a quantum system, you have to do quantum calculation. And if in this case, I mean, you have so many loops, you have so many variables, phase variables, but in the end, we also count the islands. So we are, this is a system with six quantum variables, and this one also has, it's the same step, sorry. 17 terms, since you have so many loops. Anyway, you can also calculate in phase space, so it depends what you like best. And they gave the same result. Two positions, and this is a classical calculation of, if you change the strength of the middle junction, you can change the barrier between these are the classic energies left and right, and you can change the barrier height if you change the strength of the middle junction. And these are numbers that are very similar to the and you can do the quantum calculation quite easily. Flux tilt in this case gives, as I said, you lift one value and lower the other. And this is a classical calculation, you'll stay in one of them. You can see in the board that there is a nice two-level regime around zero current here, if you chop off it. And here you see the difference between the quantum states and the classical states. But this one, I think, is also interesting. So now you have a loop, you have nine islands, or if you calculate phase, the same thing, nine quantum degrees of freedom. Now the calculation is already quite a bit more complicated, because if you do this calculation, you need, you have nine variables, but you have to include many different values. So if you do it from the charge side, EJ is larger, it means you have to admit, let's say, plus or minus 5 extra Cooper pairs to really get it right for all the states. So this might be a good problem for the people on the other side of the room. But they'll stay saying, okay, it's time to do this. And in the end, this one has to do with the Monte Carlo calculation. And I asked him for results, I asked him to do something before today, but I didn't get the answer, it's not so easy. But for him, it's also not just a project problem.
So anyway. I'm a bit confused. Why is it that you can't have solutions where the vortex is a bit bigger?
What do you mean the vortex is bigger?
It looks to me like you're just saying you've got a winding number that goes around one of these cells, and the center of the vortex is in the center of the cell.
No, you can't see the center.
Okay.
The vortex is defined by the phase difference.
Yes, but...
So what you do is calculate possibilities and then look at the current pattern. It's the only way in which you can see the vortex is here or there. So if you see here, then the current is forgotten. I'll show the current path instead.
Okay.
Anyway, we have four separate solutions. Now, again, you can calculate barriers. You can play with the currents, lower them, works in the same way. This is now a calculation, 9 degrees of freedom, and only the lower two states. This is classical, these are the lower states. This is now a function of a tilt, the current tilt. You can see that this difference is the basically half photon, the plasma, half photon energy for the plasma oscillation potential. So you can do it. I would like to see work out there, but this is getting somewhere where you make something that you couldn't easily repeat on a classical computer. Basically, you need a quantum computer to do it, but this is a quantum computer, a quantum simulator, for this particular problem. Now, there's one aspect that also should be included. I told you about this interference of vortices going around an island. Here we have a fluxoid that can sit in four different positions, I think, but I still don't know, that if we change the charts on the Bell Island, that should have a strong influence on the energy levels. There should be interference, and that should, we change this volume. So we'll say, so they'll do this calculation, but I didn't get the result yet. It should depend on that peak voltage. Now, I can also be very simple and work on my own level and then think, okay, I know what flux qubits. Flux qubits, I model them with delta and epsilon. Epsilon is the deviation of the, is dictated by the deviation from our flux column. I can tilt the flux qubit there, and I assume in that case that the spinning is the same. I can do the same here also. I can assume that I have in this array the possibility to call the tunnel from 1 to 2 to 3, etc. Not this way, not that way, but like that. So I put for the four states couplings, and here I assume them to be identical. And I can influence those things by the applied currents, so I can tilt the qubit. Now I can do this simple calculation. I get three levels in the middle. Two degenerate here, of course. These are the eigenvectors there. Of course, the lowest state is a symmetric superposition of all four positions. And here are different superpositions. If I go out here, basically, you can see that Newman-Mullen number 4, this one and that one, the tilt is... these two have lower energies than those two, and that's how I am. In the end, I have taken this one. So the ground state is a superposition of two of the original states. I can calculate the currents, and that is, this is classical calculation. So you can see that here, if the vortex is here, there are strong currents here. Here they are a bit smaller, so I can tell us there from the directions also. Now I can put them next to each other, and I know that in these lines there is a bit of extra current. There is this trapping current that's very high, but there's a bit of extra current that is influenced by where the vortex is sitting. And if I calculate that and use that as input to the neighbor, this one induces magnetic field there, and we can make that coupling significant. And what I see then is that if this is matrix form, let's say if the vortex in the, if I put two next to each other and I put the vortex here in number one here, then if the other one is also here, then the energy flow by minus one. If it's right next here, it goes up strongly, 9 Joulson energies, here it's 2 Joulson energies, and here's the one. And if I put the original one here, then I get these energies. What surprised me in the beginning, I know that the vortices repel each other, but I would think the lowest energy would be this, 4-2 or 1-3, but that's not true, and that has to do with the current distribution. There's a kind of counter flow that I don't reach, and that can be stable. So there is coupling between the qubits. And so what I hope to look at instead is, what do you expect now for a 1D chain of these things? I think it would sit like that. But of course, the other one, this, that, etc., would be the same. Have the same energy. Now I can play. I can also make it two-dimensional array. This is one arrangement with lowest energy, but there are others that are equivalent. I can influence that by putting a current line over all these things, tilt in the wrong direction, and playing with that again. So
the uppermost thing seems to be an antiferromagnet, and the 2D letters, is it a frustrated antiferromagnet? Can you refer to that?
Sorry.
I mean, the chain looks like an antiferromagnet, right?
Yes.
But the letters looks like some frustrated antiferromagnet, or?
Would you... This one here?
Yeah, sorry, the 2D letters.
Yeah. I think this is the wrong. Yeah, no, I mean, you can see. But that's because there's only here is the interaction. So this is where I am today. Before I leave here, I hope to do some more work on this and get some more ideas of what you could do with the system. So I see potentially these four-level system, four-level atoms, if you want, application could be interesting. Thank you.
Two questions. Well, just because you have this one up, I've seen some work on using little clusters of quantum dots to build more or less cellular automaton arrays to do, and with the idea that you control the one on the end and then you by bringing them together in the right way, it does logic as it propagates along. I mean, this would.
But those, like it could those have two objects. You could make that, you could also trap two vortices.
Yeah.
Now it turns out that they don't want to sit on the diagonal. Yeah. That surprised me, but classically they don't.
Anyway, I looked at those systems and they were brought to my attention because they had the word quantum in the title of the paper, but they're doing classical computing.
It's classical. The object is quantum, but the way it works is purely classical.
I don't know if a coherent version of the same idea could be made to work, but it would be that would be an interesting question.
That's what I think of. I don't know yet.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask is when you have your lattice and like a flexoid that sits in one place, I mean, could you do a quantum walk with that? Have some tunneling amplitude to the nearest neighbors and then maybe see, I don't know how the measurements would work, but with like a 1D array, could you see the sort of probability distribution you get with a 1D quantum walk?
You start with one object, you put one qubit,
and then it can go right or left.
That was the plan for our icing chain, to be able to flip one qubit and then look for what happens at certain distances.
Yeah.
For paper, yes, we can do it, but in practice it turned out very difficult. I don't think it's impossible, but you would need more time and more people to get it to really build it. These experiments are complicated to get to.
So you said you didn't think it was a good idea to use a trapped vortex as a qubit, but though vortex motion is highly coherent. So what's the essential problem?
It doesn't help in terms of the flux noise, because the flux noise is local in these loops. And if I can influence the qubit energies by a magnetic field, then also the flux noise will do the same. So it does not help against flux noise. I think it will be as good as our flux qubit, but not better necessarily.
Why wouldn't it help against flux noise? I would have thought if you...
It would only help against global flux noise from outside sources.
But your frustration would be basically fixed. So there would be some stimulus.
No, if we have these loops, each loop would have its own microscopic defects that would have their own uncorrelated flux noise. That's not what we all thought 3 years ago, but that's what we think now. I mean, the whole field. I mean, we know now that flux noise is local.
That's like an inhomogeneous problem, I guess.
Sorry?
That's like an inhomogeneous problem. For each of the packet.
Yeah.
Now in those structures with the four center cells, would it be possible to have the vertices going around in a kind of a...
Yeah, that's what I want to find out with this charge modulation. That would tell me whether these vortices do go around or not, and whether they have that path. Yeah. I think yes, they will do it. Could you drive it? That's another thing. I don't know. You need to. Yeah, you could. You could tell. Sorry. Yeah, you could. This would be interesting to know. But I don't know what the measurement should be. let's say, if you have these current lines, and we can control currents on the level of nanoseconds, so we can really tilt the qubit, the whole thing in this way and in that way. So we could lower this quarter and then have the lower one rotate around. We could do it, yes. Like that we could do experimentally quite easily with a frequency of 100 megahertz or 200 megahertz within the Korean stars, yeah? We could.
But
I don't know what you would see. That's another question.
I'm curious about whether you can have a spontaneous kind of persistent current of vortex.
Yeah.
Going around this way and that.
Yeah, but for that I...
Kind of like a third quantization.
This experiment, changing the escape voltage, or experiment could also be the calculation already. That would also tell you whether there's a persistent current of voices, whether there is interference of voices going in wrong. And that you would see if you change the voltage on that capacitor. But you could do that experimentally also. You would see it.